and welcome to Future Library. Back again after another week. And what a week it's been. I could, again, like I did after the Christmas shows that I'd recorded before Christmas, I could go into what's happened in recent events. But as I don't know when this episode's going to be out, there's no point. Because who knows? I mean, Lord, what's his face? Who sued everybody died, but we don't know what's going to happen. So anyway, I'll stop talking about that. I've got a guest again. Always do. Again, redundant saying I've got a guest. I don't know why I say it at the beginning of each show. Jonathan Dick, who has been on the show before, is back. Hello, John.
Yes, hello. And not Lord Renard, which is good news. So.
No, it was that the guy who sued everybody for...
Oh, he's in the process of doing it, I think, because apparently it's okay to be sexually aggressive if you're not proven to have done so in court.
Oh, that's the one, isn't it? I'm thinking more about the one that was falsely accused of being a paedophile, the Tory.
Oh, Thingy McAlpine, who is now, I believe, dead, regardless of when this goes out. So.
Yeah, Lord McAlpine, he's not going to be undead, let's face it.
Well, let's hope not. Maybe it'd be Tory Lord, it's not impossible. But we shall see.
Let's hope that that does not happen.
Does that tick the politics box?
That's tonight's politics section. Done. So I don't know why I'm saying tonight either, because even though it is tonight while we're recording it, listeners might be sitting, you know, in the middle of the day listening to it. I'm not doing well at the beginning of this one today. Right, okay. Jonathan has been on before. He's played in lots of bands over the years. I first met him when he was in, I was about to say Dead and Stereo, but it wasn't. It was Nikita.
It was indeed.
This is probably about 12 years ago now, or 13 years ago.
Why am I reckoning? Must have been 96, 97, something like that.
I moved to Dundee in 97, so it wouldn't have been 96.
Must be 97-ish, maybe running into 98.
Possibly, yeah. And then I remember you guys broke up at a gig that I was playing in 2000, yes. I think.
In Motherwell.
Yeah, so that was in 2000 that gig happened. I remember the year because I think I was going to Canada the next day or something like that, or the day after. So, yeah, that was in 2000. That was 14 years ago. Good Lord.
That is frightening, isn't it?
Did we discuss the breakup of that on the last one? I think maybe we did.
I think possibly, because I believe you illustrated it recently as part of your project. And, yes, that was a glorious combustion on stage for three or four, I should say, angry young men, as it were, who probably should have known better by then.
Well, it was the furious... Well, I mean, the thing was, the band I was in, Magnetic North Pole, we broke up shortly after that as well. So I think
don't go to Motherwell, that's the...
that's the tip. That's the top tip for listeners. Don't play at the Starker Bar in Motherwell unless you want your band to break up either on stage or shortly afterwards. So Jonathan has then... excuse me, he's then gone through being in Dead and Stereo, then Curators, which is in also involved a stint running a music shop.
Yep.
Is now a teacher.
I know, frightening, isn't it?
You know, which is kind of cool, I think.
Well, there are worse jobs. There are definitely
there are. You're doing something useful.
Well, I'm certainly not doing it for the money, so there's got to be some kind of good old altruism in there.
Well, I don't know. I think the money's better than a lot of jobs, to be honest, John.
Maybe down south it is.
I'm not going to be so crass as to ask about the money. well, I mean, let me put it this way.
It's a good way to make a living.
Yeah, well, I think it's one of these things. I mean, I work for a charity doing debt relief now, and I think I feel much happier doing that than working for a bank. So... you know, it's nicer to do things that are nice for people, to actually be useful for society. It's much better than working for some faceless corporation who's trying to make money off you. So.
It's interesting that you used to work for the bank. My younger brother worked for the bank for quite some time and had a big crisis of conscience a few years ago, quit and, shock horror, did his teacher training and is now teaching science in a school in inner city London. So there you go. There's a vault fast and then some.
There you go. Absolutely. It doesn't surprise me. So that's how, you know, I think that's what happens, isn't it? That people go, I can no longer take this, and they change over. So anyway, Curators.
Yes.
How long has Curators been going?
The first album came out in 2010, and we'd been going for probably about 8 months prior to that. So I think 2010 is a safe bet.
So it's a fairly short-lived... Well, I say fairly short-lived. I mean, 4 years, that's actually not short-lived. But it seems short-lived when you start to get old. And,
yes.
You know, this thing, you know, it's over in the blink of an eye. At the time, it probably seems like it's going for quite a long time. I mean, I look back at Magnetic North Pole, and I think from its inception to its end was probably about 2.5 years, maybe three.
It seems feels a lot longer.
Yeah, absolutely.
In a nice way.
Yeah, absolutely. And towards the end, in a nasty way.
But, well, yeah. I must say, not in our case. We've not had that. Ours is very different. I mean, 4 years is obviously a fairly long time, and it's not necessarily a full stop forever. But essentially, I mean, I'm about to get married. One of the guys is about to become a dad. There's all other things that are happening in, you know, in real life, as it were, which kind of mean that it's harder and harder to justify the amount of time that you need to really put into a band to do it properly. So I think rather than just whimpering out, we thought we'll do a wee recording to finish. We'll probably, I would say, in a few months' time, we'll do a proper wee farewell gig or two, and then we'll just take a bit of time. And whether that's a year, 2 years, or frankly, who knows, it's not inconceivable that we'll come and do something a little bit further in the future. But at the minute, it seems like a sensible time to draw and at least, you know, a temporary close to things.
And is the lady you're marrying the? Because obviously, the listeners to the podcast won't be able to understand this reference, but Jonathan's Skype avatar is a picture of him pointing at a screen, along with a young lady who appears to have a cup for a nose.
That she is drinking a cup of tea, and yes, that is her.
She's not drinking a cup of tea, listeners. She has a cup for a nose. Jonathan is a liar. And he's, but the thing is, the fact he's a liar is offset by the fact that he's marrying, out of pity, one should only assume, a woman who has a cup for a nose.
It's altruism, isn't it?
It is. It's kindness. I should point out to listeners, if you can hear this squeaking chair in the background, this is a first because I'm, again, I'm coughing. I'm recording the podcast upstairs for the first time. Which is unusual. Again, it's meaningless to listeners and to the guest normally because of the way the house is set up. We live in this three-story house, and the awful Sky router is downstairs on the ground floor, I should say. And by the time the signal got up to the top floor, it was always a little bit shaky. But another part of various things that people gave us in Amazon coupons and stuff over Christmas. We got a range extender. Glamorous.
So you're living in the future, basically.
Yeah, so now I'm connected to the extended network. Oh, yes. And that's very exciting. It means I can sit in the office, but it does mean that whereas before I was sitting on a chair at a dining room table, and it was a wooden chair that didn't make any noise, I'm now in an office chair that goes quite squeaky. But what is one to do? Well, so was this a joint decision with curators to draw things to a temporary or whatever lull? Or was this a...
imposed from above, is that the
was it?
The
well, imposed from above would indicate that maybe your dad had had a call, had phoned you and said, "Oi, son, what you
doing? Sort your life out."
Yeah.
No, it was. There is no... you know, there's no, sadly, there's no scandalous backstory to it. It simply was a decision that we thought, you know what, now is probably a good time to do this. In particular with, you know, a baby imminent that is going to be taking over, I think, pretty much all of the thinking space of at least one of the four of us. So it made sense to do that. I think, to be fair, there are, I mean, I and also Bob, our bassist, have been involved in other bits and pieces that are hopefully going to come together in the next little while and will be audible for people, so it's not a full stop on the music front. It's just it seemed like a good time to bring this particular thing to a bit of a pause. I mean, we've got two records we put out, a single to finish, a nice little discography. They're sort of, you know, you can download them all for free off the Bandcamp and have your own 17-track curator's anthology if you're so minded. And it was a nice way to finish. I think we've finished on a 2.5 minute essentially punk rock song, and I quite like the fact that at 33 that's going to be our last little, you know, recorded bit of music. It goes against perhaps the usual trend, which is you get slower and quieter as you get older.
No, I think it's great. I mean, I like the fact that the song was very, very concise and to the point. You seem to go for just as long as it needed to be.
Yeah.
I think is the correct way to look at it. I should really tell listeners what it's called. Hold on a second. Let me find the... Well, you can tell them because you know.
I do know, yeah, idea. Yeah. It's called Cemetery Sea, and it's a short 2.5 minute punk rock song that goes on for no longer than it has to, and I think that's a lesson that we learned I certainly learned being in bands over the years, that the younger you are, often the more tempted you are to go, that bit's quite good, let's play it 5 times before anything else happens, and actually less is usually more, unless you want to be a prog band, and let's hope that...
Well, this is always the attitude. This is the attitude we had in Magnetic North Pole, and pretty much every band I've been in for a very long time, was that you play the song for as much song as you've got.
Yes.
You don't keep going after you've run out of song.
Because there's no need, you don't have to flog, you know, maybe a living horse for 3 minutes and a dead one by five, so don't...
Exactly. Yeah.
Don't overcook it.
I mean, a good example, and I think I may have used this example before as well, was it Tasman Archer? Sleeping Satellite, maybe?
Oh, my word. I think that was on one of the Now albums I owned when I was wee. Sorry.
Yeah. Sleeping Satellite. Okay, so I'm going to tell you a bit about Sleeping Satellite, listeners. If you're unfamiliar with it, it's a song by Tasman Archer. Let's see, when did it come out? Oh, God.
We're definitely talking 90s. Probably.
Oh,
mid-
God. 22 years ago. 1992. It's only amazingly 4 minutes 15 seconds long. It does seem to have maybe enough material for about 30 seconds worth of song in it, if that. And it just goes on and on and on and on and on and on, and she just repeats the chorus over and over and over again, and it's just awful. A bit like the cough I've got. But yeah, I mean, that's a good example of a song that I thought it was. I thought when I was looked at, I mean, I just looked it up on Wikipedia there. I was expecting it to say length 9 minutes or something like that. It's not 4 minutes 15 seconds. It seems so long. It just seems endless. Just horrid. Just shit-tastic. So yeah, doing something that's only a couple of minutes long is far, far superior.
Yes, yes, I would agree. I think, yeah, you say what you've got to say and then you stop. I mean, I don't think any of the songs on any of our records are particularly long. I think the longest ones are maybe one or two are pushing possibly 5 or so minutes, and that is absolutely the extent of where we're willing to go. The vast majority are sitting roughly around the 3.5 minute sweet spot, because that's, you know, there's a reason why good pop songs of the last however many decades you want to name have roughly got that length, and it's what works. And you know, I think overstaying your welcome with a song is unnecessary, and too many bands do it.
Yes. However, I can't really talk on that, because there was a The Moths release which was 6 hours long.
Well, yeah, that does undermine the point slightly.
That's kind of the opposite, but it was a long kind of ambient thing, so that's maybe okay. I did joke at the time.
With a different point, I think. Yeah. You know, that's never going to be pretending to be a pop song. You know,
no.
there's different, I suppose, theatres in which these things can be put out.
Yeah, I mean, maybe if you have a kind of much, much slower metabolism and experience time at a different rate, then possibly it could be a pop song. But you know,
a glacial pop song.
Yeah, you'd have to live for a lot longer. So you've made the couple of albums and the couple of singles. I seem to remember there were T-shirts as well at one point, were there?
Yeah, there are. We've got a few of them left. Essentially, what we're going to do is not a fire sale as such, but there's an online cartel shop, and we're going to put what we have left up there for cost, and basically just move these things on. I like to think that there's very little or very few things in life that are more hipster, if you like, than wearing an obscure t-shirt from an obscure, now defunct Edinburgh band. So, you know, I'm expecting Portland to be buying them by the bucket load. We'll see. But yeah, they'll go up there. I think we'll do a wee bundle. We've got the first record we sold out of completely. The second one, we've got a few copies of left and some t-shirts, and we'll maybe do a deal for the two together. And at the minute, Cemetery Sea is just a digital only download. And I think for the time being, that's how it will remain. All of them are pay what you want on Bandcamp. I think at this point, it's just, you know, there's a lot of stuff I'm really proud of there, and I think the more people that have it and listen to it, and all the feedback we've ever had actually ever since the start has been, you know, overwhelmingly positive, which has been great. So it's nice to just say, you know, thanks and have this, and you know, we'll see you later. Yeah. And that's kind of the take I think that we're going for at the minute.
So the new thing that you're looking at with your bass player, what kind of form is that going to take?
Well, there's actually two distinct things there. Bob is playing guitar and writing in his now other band, which will, I suppose, become his main band, who are the rather brilliantly titled Danny Champion of Nothing, who are playing really, really down-tuned, kind of historically influenced, I went to see them actually on Friday night, really just pretty thrilling, down-tuned, fairly brutal stuff. Absolutely nothing like Curators at all. And it's cracking. I've been to see them twice, and it's really good fun. I've been working with a guy who has been in loads of Edinburgh bands as well, bands like Shields Up and Take and Chase and things, and we've been putting together and kind of... The stuff we've been writing is probably more in the vein of, I don't know, somewhere between the Wild Hearts, Weezer, and possibly even Jimmy Eat World, that kind of thing. It's me singing and my melodies and lyrics and things, and some of my music, and the majority of the rest of it being his music. So it's really nice to do something totally different with someone I've not written with before. And I think we're about 13 songs in now or something. So we're going to shave that down. We'll pick probably 10 eventually, and we will put them together, and then we'll see what we've got. But there's a few folk that are, you know, involved, and hopefully that will be a band at some point. But again, we're just getting the things together just now, and it's quite interesting to write in a different way for a different band with kind of different expectations. And it's proved to be really good fun, actually. I've been enjoying it.
So it does make me think, though, are there any secret hidden demos of Curators kicking around?
There are actually stacks and stacks and stacks. Curators is probably the most demoed four band I've ever been in, because Gary and I demoed pretty much constantly. I've got, in fact, he'll tell you, on his computer somewhere, there's a folder that just says John, which I think he'll, at last count, has something like 62 MP3s in it. I've got stacks of Gary's stuff. We did an original recorded on my 8-track at home. We did an 8-track demo, demo CD, which we used to get gigs initially, which we never actually played to anybody. But I was listening back to the other day in a spirit of some nostalgia, and it was actually, it really stands up. Some of the songs ended up being on the first album. Some are a bit heavier, actually, than what we ended up becoming. But there are lots of things. There are also lots of live acoustic recordings from radio sessions we did. And at some point, I'm going to drag them all together, and I'll maybe do an odds and sods thing.
You should. So for any Curators fans, I'm assuming such a thing exists.
A few of them, hopefully, yeah.
For any Curators fans who actually would be interested in that, are there unheard songs amongst that
cache? There are. I mean, as I'm sure all bands have, there are things that you would never want to see the light of day, and some things that you think are really good and just never quite fit for the band that you're playing in. And certainly there are plenty of them from various different times. I think what we would, if we were ever going to do something with that, I think the four of us, actually, I say that, probably the six of us, because that would also include Pete, who was our bassist on the first record, and actually John, who was the bassist on the first demos, have probably all got an input of there as well. And we'd maybe, I don't know, we'd maybe come together with a few songs, let's say 10 for argument's sake, and maybe see if we wanted to at some point do something with that. But for the time being, I think that's something that's for the future.
I think you should do it this week. I think you should just get all the demos together and stick a cover on them. The other thing, though, that you just said was that, you know, most bands will have stuff that they don't want to see the light of day. I can't relate to that, John.
Yeah?
No. Everything that the bands I was in got used for something. Everything.
I think my take on that would be, if I've done a rough demo of something which I'm not 100% happy with, sometimes I'll have taken bits of it and they'll become something else, or sometimes I'll change the melody or whatever. And although I can understand that if you were, you know, incredibly geeky and into the process of doing these things, it would be interesting to hear in a kind of almost archaeological sense, you know, you're putting together the bits that then became other things. I think for most people, that's probably more than you would ever require to hear, certainly from us. Having said that, there are some songs that I think are genuinely excellent, which just didn't fit, and are now, two of them are actually now involved in the thing I'm working on with James, and some other ones may appear in some other form in the future as well. We'll see.
I see. What I'm getting at there is that with Maps of Jupiter, Magnetic North Pole, and anything kind of after that, there were never really any demos. There were never really any...
Well, I remember you telling me a long time ago with the Magnetic North Pole recordings, it was very much a, here's the song, quickly play it, record it, that's it.
Yes.
And you don't go back to it, and you don't revisit, and you didn't re-record. It was, the kind of idea was that it was a document of what the thing was at the time. And
yes,
that appeals very much to the, I mean this as a compliment, certainly to my younger self in particular, because I mean, you probably remember when we were playing in Nikita, we were very into the idea that there had to be, you know, you could be, how do we describe it, something really pretentious like punk in ethic without sounding like a crappy punk band, I think was probably what we said at the time. But I think there is something to do with, you know, there's a certain honesty to doing things that way. And I've got somewhere in a vast pile of CDs that are staring me in the face just now, what I suppose would become the complete Magnetic North Pole, with songs that I still really enjoy listening to now, really nice little fuzzy pop songs. But I have been known to play on the acoustic guitar from time to time. So.
Well, you see, our attitude was that, yeah, as you say, we just recorded it and got on with it and then moved on to the next thing. It was, okay, there were a couple of things that were re-recorded, but we were... It's only because we record it in a studio, and then, in fact, there's a studio recording that I've got on a DAT here, which was recorded at the Forum in Aberdeen, that I've not heard in, God, 15 years or something. I can't even remember what it sounds like. I need to find something with the DAT so that I can
actually play it.
Yeah, absolutely. And then convert it over, because it's the only studio recording in a proper studio that exists of Magnetic North Pole. And it's the... it was the classic first lineup as well. Second lineup.
The purist's favourite.
Yeah, that's it. Well, I say the first lineup because the first lineup had Robbie Cooper from Lato playing drums. Mm. He played drums with us for the first two gigs and the split 7-inch we did right at the start. And then when he left to concentrate on Lato, we had John Weir from Gerald's sat in officially for a couple of gigs. That was the plan before we, whilst we were looking for a replacement drummer. And then he just stayed to the end. But yeah, so it's the John Weir, Ronnie, Maquette and me lineup. That was the kind of the classic awkward sounding lineup before.
Well, these need to see the light of day, absolutely.
Well, I need to find it. I need to dig it out. I mean, it has a version of Halo on there. It's got a song called Caterpillar Part 2. It's got a version of Misunderstood, I think, on there, with Maquette playing a xylophone on it.
Now I'm looking over at my far wall here. I have got the Sounds in Your Head Volume 2, I think it is. I can't quite see, but there certainly was a split with Magnetic North Pole and somebody, and I'm sure one of the Caterpillars was on that.
Yeah, Caterpillar Part 1 is on that. Yeah. It's the Sound in Your Head Volume 1, that one, I think.
Is it? In fact, we've got a kind of a, from where I'm standing, a sort of glacial, kind of snowy mountain type cover. Although my eyesight's not what it was, so it could be something entirely different.
They had so many different covers, those. I mean, all the ones I had all had handmade covers, and lots of people made different covers for them. So that I don't think any two covers were the same for that record.
Yeah.
So yeah, it had on one side it had us and Pentathol, went on to be members of Dan and Aykroyd, and are now in Duncan and the X-Teens. And on the other side, it had Edema, who went on to be Mutate and the Meccano set, and Halon 1301, I think, who went on to do a couple of things, and their singer went off to live in Japan. Yeah, so there's this little slice of history for the listeners.
Now, do you know, that reminds me of something else. I'm sure we talked about this last time, but the 100 members compilation CD that you put together with the council, I think most people's favourite on that song, Comfort Cake by Hamper, at the end of that. There was a song I heard on the radio the other day, and I had to go and find out what it was, because it reminded me enormously of it, and it's by a band called London Grammar, and it's called Night Call. And I'm not suggesting they've heard, but it is a less good version of Comfort Cake by Hamper, and it's now all over Radio 1, so that's how you get ahead of your time by over a decade.
Yeah, Hamper were great, and they briefly reappeared a few years ago. We recorded that version. We recorded it in one of their members' flats in Dundee.
Mm. On the day that somebody was leaving to go to a different country?
Yes, their singer was leaving to go and live in Vienna, I think, the next day. So we had to finish it that night. And I had this digital 8-track that I hadn't really used very much at the time, so I wasn't completely up to speed with how to use it. And we had to record the whole thing and the vocals and everything in this one evening. And it was recording onto zip discs, 250 meg zip discs. And it filled the disc, and we actually ran out of space for it. Which is why there should have been more vocals over that coda at the end.
Yeah,
we actually just ran out of space for the vocals on the disc, so there weren't any. So it finishes after the end of the verse. So it was a little bit. I think it was kind of like, you know, kind of la la laing over the top kind of thing.
Yeah,
and that fell by the wayside because there just wasn't enough space on the disc to put it on. that was because they'd been trying to record it, I think, themselves. And had reached, they'd kind of hit a brick wall with it. They hadn't been able to get it to sound the way they wanted. So it was like, well, I really want you guys on this thing. I've got to get over tonight and get this sorted out. So I think, is that the one? Yeah, Comfort Cake. Maybe it's a different one I'm thinking of. Maybe it's the one, because they were on a 7-inch as well.
Now, I'm fairly certain that story of the leaving for Vienna the following day did apply, because I remember I go driving around, I think Neil and I drove around to your old flat on Dens Road, maybe?
The Dens Road, yeah.
To pick up our copies of it for punting, and I'm sure that was the story that came with it. Who knows? Maybe we should ask them. I saw, I think, a video on YouTube a little while ago. They're obviously existing in some sense again now, so maybe there would be somebody to get one and talk to. That'd be good.
Yeah, I may be getting confused because I know that they gave me something for that, and they were also on the Sounds in Your Head Volume 2, the 7-inch. And I don't think there was ever a Volume 3. Yeah, I think it only went to Volume 2, and then that was it. So, which had six bands on it, because I remember it had Spray Dog from Newcastle, who are now better known as Kath and Phil Tyler, who are kind of a fairly well-known and written about in The Wire folk duo.
Oh, I see, right.
Let's see who else it was. There was my brother's band, who were called Nubia, maybe? They had a song about Elvis. And there were a few people. Hamper were on there, and I can't remember who else was on there. I think Loki may have been on there. I'm not sure.
Loved Loki. I thought they were a great band.
Loki were great.
I had a lot of time for them.
I got a bit confused actually with Loki because they had a guy called Ian in them, didn't they?
Who was then in Spyamp, I think, wasn't he? Afterwards,
yeah, he went in to be in Spyamp. Not to be confused with Owen, who is part of the Rusty Hip Collective in Dundee, who, when I interviewed the Rusty Hip Collective, I think I may have mentioned this on the podcast before as well. If I haven't, I should have done, and if I have, I apologise for repeating myself. But when I spoke to them, I was like, oh, and Owen, I first met you years ago when you were really tiny and playing in Loki when you were a little kid. He's like, I don't think you did. I was like, no, I'm pretty sure you did. You played in Loki. You had that song Dark Island, didn't you?
That's the one everyone remembers.
Yeah, he's like, no, I didn't. And I was like, are you sure now? And he goes, well, I think I am because it's my life. And I'm like thinking, my memory's usually so good. And I got the two people mixed up. So I apologise retrospectively for having done that. But Owen, Ian, you know, you can see.
Yeah, I can see where you're coming from. I think
10-year gap.
Yeah. There was also, if memory serves, Kevin, who was Stuart, who was in Magnetophone version 0.3, perhaps. His wee brother was Kevin in Loki. And and obviously Chris, who's now Esprit, who was the main man.
Yeah.
So, yeah, small. In fact, you're going to need to rewrite Hanging Around, I think, and update all these little band family trees that have progressed from when it was last finished.
Yeah, for any listeners who are unaware of what Hanging Around is, it's a book I wrote about being in bands. And it's it was written, it kind of told a little kind of slice of time, slice of history of the Dundee scene over a little chunk of it, didn't it? So,
In future future generations will refer to it as a seminal Dundee scene, I think, at that point.
But absolutely.
Kind of didn't realise quite how good it was until it was finished. It felt probably different from the inside than it now looks back from the outside.
Yeah, this is the thing. I mean, I think listeners to the podcast will be getting tired of me banging on about this, that it really did seem that kind of late 90s to about 93 kind of era, like 4 or 5 years across there, seemed to be a kind of golden era for the city. And it may just be because that was the era that we were all active in it, and that's why we look back and think of it as the golden era, and that everybody now looks back at their own era and thinks that's the golden era. But I kind of think those people who think that their era is the golden era are wrong.
I would agree entirely, definitely 100% wrong.
Yeah, whereas we are right. absolutely right in every single way. So
infallible, in fact.
Infallibly right, almost like the Pope.
With, you know, better attitude towards several important things.
Yes.
But yes, enough of that. I think that's really, it's a really exciting time. It was a really exciting time, and it's a good read, so you should pick it up.
Oh, thank you. Yes, it's a book. It goes from my first band right through to probably about 3 or 4 years ago in its latest incarnation, and then it stops. But it kind of, I kind of liked where the original version of it stopped, because the original version, the first...
I think I've got the original version.
It's the one that finishes when I leave Dundee.
Yeah.
I think, yeah. And I think that seemed actually to be a really good place to finish it. And then when I went back and revised it, I kind of added in bits going on for several years. And the story gets less exciting. And the thing is, there's less to tell. I mean, I don't see any point in going back to it at all now to revise it, because there's not much to tell. It's like, you know, well, this year I did this and this year I did that. And...
Yes, yeah, so it's more of just an update for the sake of it rather than adding to a narrative.
Yeah, it's like the kind of... dramatic kind of narrative is a thing of then rather than now.
And yeah, I think so.
Yeah, maybe it's a thing of, you know, being younger and being more involved, you know, whereas, you know, now I think I'm still kind of involved, but less.
In a different way.
In a different way. I mean, like doing this, and I am still doing music stuff, but not as much, and, you know, there's various things, and it all works out in the end, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think that's
you know, nobody's been killed as a result of anything I've put out, so... or anything you've put out, I assume.
Well, I would hope not, yeah. The night is young, or the morning if you're listening in the morning, so we'll find out.
We've not yet heard of the Curator's Killer.
No, but there's a Channel 5 Sunday Night Filler documentary, if ever I heard of one.
Yes, the inspired by Cemetery Sea. A lunatic in Edinburgh decides to fill the sea with the dead.
It writes itself.
It does, doesn't it? It's I can see it almost being a cop drama on STV.
Yeah, a hardened, wizened old Scots cop paired up maybe with a young, just straight out of training. Yeah, I could see that working. That would be good.
And it would use Cemetery Sea as the opening music.
Indeed, and then I would retire on the wonderful PRS payments, and all would be great in the world.
Oh, PRS payments. I've earned virtually nothing from those. yeah, I was going to say, actually, I'm trying to get another kind of return from the past band, Mouse Eat Mouse, on. And they had a song called Hush Noo on their first album. Are you familiar with Mouse Eat Mouse?
Yes, not particularly in terms of the back catalogue, but I am aware of their existence, yes.
Well, they have this song was Hush Noo, Hush Noo, Death Strunts Thurrigs. It's the first line of Hush Noo. So it's like, you know, hush now, Death Strunts the Rigs. And I could have imagined that was the theme tune to the follow-up to Snakes on a Plane, which would have been Pigs on a Rig. and I may have talked about this in the podcast before, and if I have, again, I apologise. But Pigs on a Rig was going to be... well, the song talks about... one of the lines is, do you ken Johnny Peel? I ken him too weel. And I liked the idea that Johnny Peel was actually this hardened New York oil rig inspector sent to the North Sea to investigate the deaths of some people working on a North Sea oil rig. And it turns out that there's killer pigs on the rig. And, you know, that's the death strunts the rigs, is the pigs attacking people on the oil rig. And Johnny Peel's there, you know, probably played by Samuel L. Jackson or somebody. Or maybe now Simon Pegg putting on an American accent.
Well, why not?
Yeah, that would work. Yeah, and so it would be pigs on a rig.
I can't see what's wrong with that as a concept either.
Again,
I'm sure it worked really well.
It's written itself just from a few lines of the song. And then you have the song at the end. And, you know, you occasionally have an orchestral version of it throughout the film. Because I think that would be a film rather than a series, whereas I think Cemetery Sea would be a five-part drama.
Yeah, well, they'd have to use the artwork as part of the cover, because, wonderfully, I was having a drink in the pub over the road from my flat, and there's a guy called Kenny who does a lot of sort of handicrafts and things, and we were chatting about... somehow it turned to pirates. I think it was... In fact, it was because they were having a pirate-themed New Year's do in the pub. And he said, oh, I've got something, and his flat's around the corner, and he nipped out to get it. And he came back with a piece of driftwood, which must be, I mean, at least 100 years old, but he had sat on the beach and he carved into the front of it this sort of relief of a skull. And I thought, well, that looks kind of awesome. And I'd sort of started to put two and two together and thinking, we've been looking for something that's going to work for this. I wonder if we could borrow it. And in the end, he gave me it. I gave him I think it was 20 quid or something. And I've now got it currently hanging in my living room, much to most people that come here's dismay. But it ended up looking brilliant. And as I say, we went down Portobello Beach, took the photo that's now on the cover, and it looks, I think it does exactly what we wanted that particular cover to do. And it was all very much good fortune and the benefits of going for a quick pint after work. So there you go.
And it did sound slightly in the background, like for a moment there, that you were using a lathe to actually shave some of the shavings off the top.
That will be the cat, which was just wandering around scratching on things, as they tend to do.
Luckily, my cat, I don't know where she is actually at the moment. She has made appearances on the show a few times and regularly turns up in my other podcast, which is a video podcast. But I think she's probably downstairs with my missus at the moment. So, they do have a habit of getting up and stroking their tails against microphones and things. Again, it's a kind of look behind the curtain for listeners who need to know these details.
It's these little details that really fill out the picture, I think.
It's not the kind of thing that the people have to deal with at Radio 1, I'll tell you that.
No, but then they do have to play things like that. Just flabbergastingly horrific. What was that song called? Timber, I think it is. Is it? Yeah, Timber with Kesha and Pitbull, which I attacked my ears on the way to work the other day, and is one of those you'd laugh if it wasn't so tragic type moments. But that got to number one in the Fair Country Recall Home. So, what are we doing? Well, I recommend that you go and YouTube it and bask in its horror once we're done.
I may do that, or I may just take your advice and not listen to it at all.
In many ways, your life would be better if you did the latter.
It kind of weirdly fits in with my inclinations anyway, because I often say to people, "Yes, I'll definitely do that," and then I don't. You know, it's that whole kind of like, oh yeah, send me that, I'll read it, and then I don't. Or they say, listen to this, then I don't. And but luckily, I actually did listen to your track yesterday.
Well, that's rather handy, isn't it?
I looked at it and thought 2:42, I can give that time up.
Well, that's the trick, that's why the shorter the better, isn't it? You take up less of people's time.
Yeah, if it had been 3 minutes, I'd have been skipping forward.
We'll go for the last chorus. That's going to tell me everything I need to know.
Yeah, cutting it down to 30 seconds, finding some software that would just take out the essential parts and remix it for me.
The three best syllables, that's really all you need.
Yeah, maybe just the name is more than enough.
True. And then just see, much like having books on your shelf that have never been opened, you just see and listen to it.
Or maybe just knowing it exists and not even opening the web page, which is at curators.bandcamp.com for those who actually want to hear it. So, obviously, from your accent, listeners are going to be able to tell that you're a Scot.
Indeed.
Like myself, but I don't have the accent. But I was actually born in Glasgow, so there you go. This year, I think, it's the big...
Referendum. Yes, it is indeed.
What are your thoughts on this?
I've got to be quite careful. I am, as you said, a teacher, and we are actually under... I was going to say, if that's not true. Under very strict instructions from the council, we are not allowed in any way to influence the young people who may have a vote for the first time.
Is your cat going kind of crazy there, by the way?
Yes, I've just chewed him off. That should be better. Yes. Are we there?
Yeah, excellent. That's fine. Yeah, it sounded like somebody was sharpening a guillotine.
Yes, well, he has got very sharp fangs, but he's got. But essentially, my position is actually very undecided at this point. The way I look at it is that I think politically, in terms of the political spectrum, Scotland is a distinct entity. I think anyone would say it's fairly obvious that Scotland politically is more left of centre than Westminster represents, and certainly more left of centre than the south of England. Mm-hmm. I think socially there is a case. I think we have different priorities in terms of you might term more progressive, sort of small s socialist type of ideas, in terms of our approach to education, our approach to healthcare, our approach to perhaps looking after the most vulnerable in society. The one that is going to be crucial and the one that will make people vote yes or no is going to be that economic argument. And it is so clouded by disinformation and fear-mongering from both sides. I genuinely am on the fence. I can say that without thinking I have to say that. I think the economic argument is the one that's going to swing it. And if I'm honest, I suspect what will happen is that there will be a no vote, but nowhere near as clear-cut a no vote as some people might seem to think. Mm. And I think, and what I really hope does happen, is that a significant, albeit probably a minority yes vote, does force an acknowledgement that something needs to change, because everybody would have voted, I think almost without question, apart from really diehard nationalists, everyone would have voted for devolution max had it been offered. And whichever way this referendum goes, it'll either be a good move by Cameron or a good move by Salmond. But removing that middle option and making it a straight yes-no actually denies the majority of the people who live in Scotland the chance to say this is what we want, because it is sensible and it would make sense. We are distinct in many ways, so we need more tax-based powers. We need more autonomy in that sense. But that could still be done within the wider, if you like, umbrella of Great Britain, mm-hmm. however you interpret that as a concept. I still think it's a shame that we're not going to be given that option as another question, if you like. But it's interesting, and there's a debate between, I suppose, heart and mind here, and a little bit of me. I mean, and this is a strange thing to say, but as a history teacher, you teach about key moments in history, things mm-hmm. that change lives for people for the better and for the worst. And there's a bit of me that the younger bit of me, perhaps, which goes, you know what, sod it, I'd like to live through one of them and see what it's like. Another bit of me that's probably the same young bit goes, are we going to be any worse off? Are we going to be worse represented? Are we going to have worse politicians, worse corruption, worse bribery, worse just complete disconnection from politics. Are we going to be in a position where that's any worse through independence? I mean, I'm not sure. I talk to kids at school who are far more politically aware than they're given credit for in the media. The idea that I could convince them to vote one way or another is hilarious if you actually meet them. But then most people are saying these things haven't. But what I would say is they are, as a generation, notably disengaged from politics for entirely valid reasons. Because at least for me, I can look back to, before everything went wrong afterwards, I can look back to 1997 and say, look, there was a moment where there was a genuine optimism around politics, a real sea change in who the government was going to be, a real rejection of old, in this instance, conservatism, all that stuff, and there was optimism. Now, these kids who are now 16, 17, 18, all they have experienced is corruption, bribery. All they've read about is the scandals of politics, the expenses, the ridiculous positions that politics is. All they see on telly is rich, privately educated people shouting at each other about things that they don't relate to themselves. And who can blame them for going, you know, I don't care. I'm not interested in that. None of these people speak for me. And there is an issue with our supposed three-party system, whereby the Liberal Democrats have made themselves unelectable in Scotland, probably for 10 years by cozying up to the Tories. Labour will always be safe in some senses. You could put a telly with a Labour rosette in some seats and they would vote for them. Mm-hmm. There will never be a significant proportion of Conservative MPs in Scotland for all of the obvious reasons. But there is, and this is where the SNP have really, I think, mopped up. By positioning themselves as a leftist centre party in the last Scottish election, the SNP picked up a significant number of votes from people who weren't interested in independence, but were interested in a genuine, relatively left of centre, but still moderate democratic party. And the only party fulfilling that role properly was the SNP in the last Scottish elections, which is one of the reasons why they did so well. And there has to be an acknowledgement that something is broken here. Something has to give. And if that thing that gives is that Scotland becomes independent, well, bits of me think, you know, good luck to us. Let's see what we can do. If it doesn't go that way, there needs to be change, because where we are just now is not working. And it is disengaging an entire generation, people who think the word politician equates to crook. And it is as simple as that. And I have sympathy with that as a concept, but not everyone is. Part of the higher course that we teach in history is to do with the post-war Labour government and the introduction of the NHS and the welfare state. And one of the biggest challenges is getting children to realise that the term welfare state is not necessarily pejorative. It is, the idea of welfare is in some sense a positive word. It's a positive concept. And yet we're fighting against the tabloid narrative that focuses on things like Benefit Street and Channel 4 and the small minority of, and I'm not suggesting they don't exist, but the benefits cheats, this nebulous concept of a benefit tourist, whoever the hell that is, at the same time as we're willfully, ignoring, enormous tax evasion and avoidance, all this sort of stuff. I mean, our priorities are all over the place. And I think you get intelligent kids who look at that and go, that's not for me. This is just old, rich men shouting. And why do I want to have anything to do with that? And I sympathise entirely with the point of view. I just hope that something will happen that can get them back involved, because we've got a lot of very, very, very intelligent young people. Two of my kids from last year who've just got applications accepted for institutions like Cambridge and Oxford, the kind of guys who are going to go there from a Scottish state school, and they will probably have a hard time because of that. But hopefully we'll have enough of a basis and things to challenge this kind of dominant idea that this is how things that work, and this is how you get to Westminster, and this is what you do as a politician, and you stand facing each other and shout and heckle and jeer and behave like children in the worst possible way and watch as people turn their tellies off. That's no way for a democracy to run. So, yeah. Here endeth the lesson.
No, I absolutely agree with you. I think absolutely with what you're saying about the welfare, the word welfare itself was spot on, because it has, in the same way as the word union and the same way as the word socialist, those words were kind of poisoned by, really, let's not beat about the bush, by Thatcher's government, that made out that anything socialist was bad, unions were a terrible thing that make people lose their jobs, and that welfare was a terrible thing because it keeps the work-shy masses in flat-screen TVs and caviar and whatever else they're supposedly meant to eat. As Charlie Brooker pointed out, all TVs are flat-screen TVs, so it's a bit irrelevant to say that. But, and as he also pointed out, how dare poor people want things? Who do they think they are? He pointed out sarcastically. People who haven't got any money have got as much right to try and live comfortably as anybody else. But I think as I've aged, I found that I've become very, very pro-trade union. I was a union rep for the PCS when I was working for the Inland Revenue in Dundee. Mm-hmm. Uh, I I think socialism's a fantastic idea. I'm actually reaching the point where, give me another 10 years, I'll probably be a communist. and I think the welfare state is essential. I think you're only as strong as the weakest member of your society. So you have to do something about that. You have to make sure that people are pulled up. You look at, you know, states in Scandinavia, look at these countries in Scandinavia that have got benefit payments that are almost on a par with what the people earn when they're working, and that have prison systems that concentrate on rehabilitation rather than punishment. And they, all these places have much, much better standards of life. People are on the dole for less time. They're happy to pay higher taxes because they know that the state will catch them if they fall over. And they feel far more engaged in the state because they realise they're part of it. And I think what's happened in the UK has been that disconnect between what the people in Westminster are doing and what the rest of us are doing. And I think what should be happening is that we need to remember that the only reason we have MPs is because all of us can't go to Parliament.
Exactly. And something that I think is forgotten a lot. I mean, in terms of the what you're saying there about the welfare state, which I think is absolutely correct, you are only as strong as the weakest member of your society. But we have this odd double thing that nobody really picks up on. You know, you've got this narrative about scroungers and all this sort of stuff, skivers and all these sort of things. And we talk about generational unemployment and generational welfare dependency. And these things exist, and nobody's pretending they don't exist. They don't exist in the numbers that the media presents, as we know, but they do exist. However, we live in a country which, if you go back 30 years, had an enormous, let's say, manufacturing industry. Let's take the obvious one, had an enormous mining industry. And when these things are collapsed or, in some instances, perhaps dismantled with a degree of prejudice, as you alluded to earlier, then those jobs go with them. And we talk about, you know, creating jobs and getting people into welfare, off welfare and into jobs. Such a massive proportion of what did give Britain the working class that is almost like the classic idea of a working class, the kind of thing that people almost hark back to as halcyon days, you know, that doesn't exist anymore. We don't have those things. In some sense, I suppose a call centre is the modern take on a factory. Mm-hmm. And that in itself is depressing, but we don't have that. Those things we prioritize, I suppose, profit and business above other things. We outsource to other countries. We do all of these bits and pieces in the interest of making money for a small minority of people, whilst the majority do not have access to that. How then can we turn around and be surprised when there's an issue with people struggling to find work? And again, this idea that people are happy to live on benefits for generations and generations, yes, there are a small minority of people who are in that position, but the vast majority of people want to, if not work, at least to earn. They want to have, there's the dignity and the self-respect that comes with that, that seems to get totally roughshod over by the narrative that's in the press, some bits of the press, not all the press, I must say. You get to a stage where you get guys like, what's his name, it's Owen Jones, having to go on Channel 4 News to point out the issues and to back up with facts the issues that people are having with a programme like Benefit Street because of what it presents and what it then causes, especially online, with this just stream of invective and hate coming from people who don't know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I'm not suggesting for a minute that means I know what I'm talking about. All I'm suggesting is if teaching history does teach you nothing else, there are always two sides to a story. You need to be aware of both of them. And anyone who jumps to one extreme or the other will tend to end up with either their fingers burnt or the fingers of others burnt. It does not end well. And then you can, you know, you can play Godwin's Law and ramp it up all you like. But we are so divided in some sense to be, I suppose it's divided in real time instead, isn't it? I mean, even you listen to the language, especially of the current government, and this is why the Lib Dems have just written themselves out of the picture, certainly in Scotland for the foreseeable future, because they are part and parcel of this, if you like, enablers of this. You've got a government which is obviously pursuing a tactic of divide and rule. If you start using in speeches the term striver and skiver or whatever else, there are two types of people in the world, this and this. But what type are you, Mr. Cameron, with your millionaire background, or Mr. Osborne with your millionaire background, or Ian Duncan Smith living off your wife's father's money, or whoever else you want to pick out of that cabinet, who's never going to struggle and will never empathise with people's position on the ground. Now, I say this as somebody who, when we closed down the shop, it was a genuinely terrible time, financially ruinous, lots of potential things that I thought were going to happen that I'm happy to say didn't at that point, but it was a point where I was, there's a low ebb in my life, and you look to things, well, what have I got if I need help? And I live in a country whereby if I really needed it, I would have enough money to survive on the dole. I would be able to get somewhere to live. and I would be able to go to hospital to help myself if I got ill. How can we possibly say that there is something bad about that? As a concept, as a principle, the fact that if you are ill, our country will try to make you healthy. If you've got nowhere to live, our country will try, and not all that successfully. I'm not suggesting this is, you know, some sort of rose-tinted or, I suppose, red-tinted run on things. But we have things that are better than nothing. And yet the alternative at the minute seems to be to want to try and return to nothing. And that strikes me as ruinous for what we are. And I think that narrative is the one that plays into the hands of yes votes in the independence campaign. Because what people expect and how we spend our money, even down to things like nutrition fees and what have you, the dominant base level ideology, I think, in Scotland is slightly left of centre, and that's not the case at Westminster. And people down south will say, oh, you guys have got your free education for university, how fair is that? Well, we've chosen to spend money that we have, which we've got from Westminster, after paying more than what we've got from Westminster back in tax, and that's another myth that comes up the whole time. But we've chosen to spend that money on things like ensuring that there are prescriptions for this group of society, that there is no tuition fee, or there are, I should say, no tuition fees for people in this position. We've chosen to do these things because the politics of our country suggests that that's what we think most people want. What we've chosen not to do is what's happening in England with education, which is backdoor privatisation, what's happening with the NHS, which is increasingly not even backdoor privatisation. We've not we've objected to the selling off of the Royal Mail to a company which then actually made millions and millions of pounds on the shares being undervalued initially. Mm-hmm. That, conveniently, that same company which then gave a massive donation to the Tory party shortly afterwards. It's out and out politicking and corruption. And it's no surprise that an increasing number of people in Scotland are saying, do you know what, I'm not interested. Let's have our own corruption. Let's at least make it a little bit easier to see, perhaps, because Westminster feels very, very distant to folk.
Yes.
I mean, teaching about politics in a school in Edinburgh, Westminster may as well be on the moon. And I don't think there's any realisation of that, actually, in Westminster. I mean, London is massively London-centric. It's very hard for people living in London to see out with the country. Now, Westminster is the absolute epicentre of that. And it's disgusting to watch these kind of massively wealthy boo boys just heckling and shouting each other, playing politics, when these decisions have real implications for real live people who are the absolute majority. I fall short of saying the 99% because that buys into another, you know, narrative entirely. But the vast majority of people are affected in real terms by what these people are just shouting about. Mm-hmm. And that's, for me, that's not acceptable. I know you have a beep in the background. I actually also have a beep in the background.
I'm not sure why I've got a beep in the background. Oh, I think it's a fire alarm. Oh, I think my wife set fire to the house.
Is that as good a time as any, maybe to get my dinner, frankly.
So. I think after you've expressed that so eloquently, I think anything else in the podcast would be just not even icing on the cake. It would be like a damp lettuce leaf after a fantastic filling meal. So I think that's a great place to finish. Jonathan, it's been a pleasure speaking to you.
As ever, Alex, as ever.
Listeners, I hope you've enjoyed that. This is why I like doing the podcast, because we can start on one topic and go completely off on something else, and that's how it should be. So that's all good. So all that's left to say then is a future library goodbye, and thanks for listening. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Future Library. Future Library is brought to you by PetPiranha.com and is hosted by myself, Alex Bottom. The podcast is free, but if you do want to show your appreciation, feel free to go along to alexbottom.co.uk and click through to music, where you'll be able to find things that you can buy, or go to asmallglassghost.co.uk where you can buy my latest music. Episodes come out when I feel like it, mostly weekly. But that's it, so thank you for listening.